so joyful to be here. It feels like a party or something. Will you join me in opening prayer? Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Mother.
Blessed Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
From Yogananda's lessons, our conception of God. The usual conception of God is that he is superhuman, infinite, omnipresent, and omniscient. But in this general conception, there are many variations. Whatever conception we have of God, if it does not influence our daily conduct, if our everyday life does not find an inspiration from it, and if it is not found to be universally necessary, then that conception is useless. If God is not conceived in such a way that we cannot do without him in the satisfaction of a want, in our dealings with people, in earning money, in reading a book, in passing an examination, in doing the most trifling or the highest duties, then it is plain that we have not felt any connection between God and life. Intuition is the direct grasp of truth. It is intuition that bliss consciousness or God consciousness is realized. God is bliss. He is ever existent. When we wish eternal bliss or God, we also wish eternal, immortal, unchangeable, ever conscious existence. It's been a wonderful time over the last couple of months since I've come out of silence at Cloud Mountain to go around and visit with so many different devotees here and there. The joy that I feel in this God consciousness, what Master is describing here, is sweet beyond measure. There is nothing that really compares to it. And yet, most people live in ignorance of that joy. They live a life that's concerned with things of the world, with making a living, with raising a family. And while these are good and noble things, they do not give us the reality that the soul is thirsting for. All people are looking for happiness. Everyone has their own theory about how to find happiness. They don't oftentimes think of it that way. Some people have the theory that happiness comes by living a good life, and certainly that does bring a measure of happiness. Some people come to the conclusion that perhaps happiness they find at the end of the bottle by drinking alcohol or through drugs, or sexual promiscuousness, or a variety of ways through the senses that they try to find happiness, try to find bliss. In the creation of this cosmos, in the creation of this individual human being. Bliss is the author, Ananda. It is one with God. It is part of God. Within Ananda is this tremendous love, upliftment, purity, light. And yet most people wander in ignorance of it. The great awakening that the Buddha went through was the awakening to the fact that beyond this material existence within his own spiritual being was the completeness, was the perfection that he was looking for. In his own early life, as the story goes, he was given everything because his father, who was a king, was told that if he were to see any suffering, he would become a wandering mendicant. If he saw no suffering before his 21st year, then he would become a king. Well, his father was a king. Naturally, he wanted his son to become a king. So he tried to shield him from any knowledge of any suffering at all. Through an experience that he had one day out with his charioteer, he came across an old man. Well, all people who aged were swept out of his life before that, and they didn't even know where this aged man came from. So the Buddha asked the charioteer, "Stop here. What is this? Look at, he has wrinkles on his face. He's bent over. He's not strong. He's not beautiful. What is this? And the charioteer said, "Well, this is old age." "Oh. Do kings get aged?" "Yeah, even kings do." "Oh." They rode on a little bit further. They saw somebody off to the side of the road, lying there that had boils and sores all over, groaning in pain. And he said, "What is this?" He said, "This is sickness." He'd never seen sickness before. "Do kings get sick?" "Yes, kings get sick too." "Oh." They ride on some more time. He sees a body. It's cold, lifeless. "Dad, what is this?" "This is death." "And kings die too?" "Yes." In the same way, we are all surrounded by old age, illness, and death, and yet we don't see it. We don't realize it. And so, because we're blind to it, we act as if it's not true. We act as if we'll live forever. We have that conception that's constantly working on us, that it's in the background. We know that old age is there. We know that death is there. We know that sickness is there, but we act as if it'll never affect us. And in that fantasy, we just continue on in our lives. But there are times in our life when suddenly we're struck with it, we're hit with it. It comes into our face. We can't ignore it. We're like the Buddha who's out on the path, out on the road. And suddenly he encounters it and he awakens to it. It's like he's seeing it for the first time. This is our ultimate destiny. And that's why in the Buddha's first teachings, that his first teaching is life is suffering. And it's not saying that all life is bad, but it's saying that it ultimately ends up in suffering. Because it ultimately ends up in us leaving everything that we thought would make us happy. And that is the beginning of wisdom. A second noble truth is, what is the cause of that suffering? It's attachment. Attachment to what? Attachment to this body. Now, why is attachment the problem? It is because it makes us believe that we are only this body, that we have fallen into this state of amnesia, that we are really a soul. And the fact is that we have a body, but we're not this body. But we've come to believe that I am this body. It has a name, it has an occupation, it does certain things, it has a relationship with the world. But the reality is that I'm not this body. So when I'm attached to this body, to the extent that it obliterates my awareness of who I truly am, then I am inevitably going to encounter suffering. And that the way to move out of that ignorance, soul ignorance, is to recover the idea that I am not just this body. And when we do that, we take another step into wisdom and we learn detachment. And that we have to become detached in order to discover who we really are. Because our mind is so filled with the things of the senses, so filled with our ideas of how things are, how the universe works, our relationship to this universe, that there's no place to reflect this intuitive truth that Master is talking about. And it is only until we begin to awaken to this intuitive truth, this oneness of spirit, that we can begin to really enter into understanding of who and what we truly are. Now, the Buddha was a yoni, and so he concentrated on the fact that detachment and learning to discern what is truth and what is falsehood is the way to enter into this consciousness. There is an alternative way of looking at things, and it tends to be more the way, certainly the way that Mother taught and Master taught, Papa Ramdas taught, this lineage. It's reflected more in the way that Krishna taught. And that is that we can take as an article of faith in the beginning that it is God who has made everything, and therefore, even to say that God made everything isn't quite true, because God is everything. There's a wonderful story of some scientists who had discovered how to generate new life and really kind of figured they had a handle on the universe and how it operated. So they got a little bit arrogant. So they called God in and they said, "Well, God, we've discovered all these great truths. We can do basically whatever you can do, and we think we can dispense with you now. We really don't need you." God said, "Well, that's interesting. It's an interesting idea." He said, "Would you like to put it to the test?" Of course, they were a little bit arrogant, so they said, "Yeah, of course, we'll have a contest with you." So he said, "I want you to create a life form." Well, they knew genetic science, and they knew how to take some earth and put it in a test tube and generate some life from that. So they went over to grab some ground in order to put it in the test tube and create new life. So they're picking up this earth, and God said, "No, no, no, no." He says, "You get your own earth. You get your own soil." And of course, that's not possible. It's not possible because it is, this universe is God stuff. It's made up of the very nature of God. And so it is said that Prakriti, or this divine expression as all material creation, is one with God. And that it's made up of two primary substances. One is Ananda, and that is blissful exuberance that has gone out, so to speak, it's a way of thinking about it, has gone out from God's nature and expressed itself as all material creation. And that this Chit consciousness, which is divine love and intelligence, shines upon it. And when this divine light and love shines upon this blissful creation, it becomes aware of itself. And so our very nature is made up of bliss, it's made up of light, and is made up of love, and that it has an eternal existence. We are all made up of that. And that our primary challenge in our life, our primary goal in life, the reason why we are here, is to rediscover our own spiritual origins, our own nature. It's not just learning a philosophy. It's not just listening to some good words. But it's by going into the laboratory of our own being and discovering the truth. And it is through these yoga teachings, these teachings that Yogananda brought from the East that have been known about in the West, but somehow were lost during the Dark Ages. Original Christianity had all of this truth in it. Whenever the yogis read the scriptures of the New Testament and the Old Testament, they look at those individuals and they say, that's us. What they're describing is what we experience. And though it's clothed in a different language and different customs, nevertheless, we recognize the truth of it. In our language, Jesus is an avatar. He is descent of divinity into flesh. That the miracles that he performed, we well recognize. That the consciousness that he's talking about attaining to, becoming a son of God, we have talked about also for thousands and thousands of years. And there is very strong belief in India that Jesus had traveled there. They say that there is some evidence for this. And there have been some books written about this. The main idea is that these truths are universal. That no one religion can claim authority. And this is very important to recognize in this day and age, because there are religious wars. There is a kind of religious war going on right now. And one way of thinking about it is orthodoxy versus a universal vision. And those who have more of a universal vision, reflected through certain ideals that some countries uphold versus what other cultures uphold, are bumping up, they're clashing against each other. And we're seeing that played out before us right now. It is vitally important that at this time we adhere to the highest truth, to the highest light within ourselves. Sometimes we see these large events happening in the world and we think, well, I'm just one individual, what can I do? But when one individual lives up to the light within their own being, that radiates out. First, it transforms their own life. It influences and changes the lives of the people who are in their immediate sphere. And then those vibrations go out, even unknown to themselves, to the world at large, and helps change the world. When one person awakens the light within themselves, it helps to awaken light within other people as well. And so we're all called upon to live up to that light. And the spiritual law is this, that those who live up to their Dharma, that light, that truth within them, they benefit and the society benefits. But if somebody lives according to a Dharma, they go against that truth, that inner light, then that individual, their consciousness is degraded. And society as a whole is degraded. And so the life that you live, how you conduct your life, choices that you make, what you focus your mind upon, makes a difference. Makes a difference to you, and it makes a difference to everyone. And that if all individuals were living according to their own highest light, and it doesn't have to be sophisticated philosophy, you could take the golden rule Do unto others as you would be done unto. Treat other people the same way you would like to be treated. Take that one thing and universalize that. Have every individual act according to that. And this world would be so transformed that it would become a Garden of Eden. It would become a paradise. We have everything that we need to make this world work, to make people happy. We have all the resources. We have all the intelligence. We have everything to live in harmony with nature's laws and with God's laws, higher spiritual laws. And by us adhering to that first, Master used to say, change yourself and you will change thousands. Change your own life and then you will change others. But so many people are willing to prescribe for others, but they themselves don't want to take the medicine. They don't want to do it. They don't want to do the work. And so willing to tell others what to do, how they ought to be, and yet so unwilling themselves to follow the prescription. So we must first prove the truths that we adhere to within our own lives, change our own lives, be in that uplifted consciousness first, and then we will help this world to change. Papa used to say, you can do no good until you have realization. That's quite a statement, that you can do no good. And the reality is you can do no predictable good, because that this individual human consciousness doesn't know how to conduct itself for the highest good of all. It operates always by limited information. But when you access the universal consciousness within your own self, it is by nature connected with the whole. And it is interested by its own nature in the upliftment and the good of the whole. So when you have this intuitive perception and operate by it, you are operating for the highest good for yourself and for everybody else concerned. Isn't that beautiful? It's wonderful. And it's simple. You don't have to be clever. In fact, the clever mind is one of the things that gets in our way. The clever mind is the one who's not listening to that divine intuitive perception. It's always running, 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 running. What do I do? How do I get a best angle? What works best here? How do I get ahead? Am I behind? And it's not still. It's not listening. It's not open to that divine perception. So we're all called upon. When Mother Teresa said, well, you're a saint, she says, we're all called upon to be saints. We're all called upon. And so it's no shifting the buck to, well, there's powers in this world that were working against the people's interests and so on and so forth. Certainly there are times that that's true. Certainly there are material powers that are beyond our own ability to match in a material way. But when we access that spiritual power, then we access something that is much greater than anyone else's material power. We know who Jesus' name is, but do you know who the wealthy people were? Do you know who the rulers are? Oftentimes we only know them because the scriptures point them out as being bad people, and so we know them by that nature. We know who Saint Francis is, but do we know necessarily who the Pope was at that time or who the kings were at that time? You see, their names continue to ring in our consciousness, to ring in our ears. But those who were worldly at the time, those who were wealthy at the time, those who had great power at the time, have disappeared into dusty history books. that are not remembered in the same way, that do not continue to influence people in the same way, that do not continue to change lives in the same way. So if we want to make our life count, if we want to change our lives and change the lives of others, then we must do the work to go in and discover this divine intuitive perception where we realize that we are one with that divine presence and we see that divine presence everywhere about us. That this world itself is made up of God stuff. That we live in that bliss, we live in that joy, that every decision that we make, there's no aspect of our life that's left untouched. And when we have the touch of that divine, our lives are transformed for the better. For the better. When I was riding on the plane coming in today, it was bumpy weather coming down. And so the plane was taking some pretty good falls and bumps and back and forth. And so within my own heart, I just saw this light like a flame of a candle burning steady, burning strong. And in the midst of all the jolts and getting knocked back and forth and up and down, that flame just burned steady. And within the hearts of everyone else in the plane, including the captain and those who were riding in front, I just saw in my mind that steady flame. It was calm. It was composed. It was residing in the light and in the peace. That same flame is burning in each one of your hearts. That same flame is burning in the hearts of all. And when we see that flame burning within our own hearts and in the hearts of all, then we see truly. Now, people are more than willing to throw shadows at us. They're more than willing to be in that delusion. And when we focus on that, when we focus on, well, this person is such and such, they're a terrible person, or they make bad decisions, or look at how they act, and so on and so forth. We only add power to that because our thoughts have power. It goes out from us. And we end up supporting, sometimes inadvertently, somebody's bad habits because that's what we talk about to others. That's why gossip is so destructive, because suddenly you have a group conscious all focusing on somebody's negative habits, whether it's true or not. And you give power to those negative habits when you do that. And then are you a blessing in life or are you a curse? By your own thoughts. But when we look through the shadows and we spy the light glowing within their heart, then you give power to the light within that one. When you interact with somebody and you look for that light, what is the good there? They may be throwing a lot of shadows at you, but you look for the good. You try to draw out that good. Then you give power to that good. And then you're a blessing in life. And the wonderful thing about it is that you are also a blessing to yourself, because when you're focusing on the light in somebody else, you're also focusing on the light within yourself. You know, the same mind that we use to judge this world, we judge ourselves first. And if we're very critical of others and we're very critical of this world, we're going to be first very critical with ourselves. And that's a difficult judge to live with, because we live with that judge 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so we are for the first recipient of our own thoughts. As God told me some one time, somewhat humorously, he says, make your words sweet. So when you have to eat those words, They're sweet. Those words are bitter and we have to eat them. That's not so good. They don't taste so good. So make your words sweet. And if you have to eat them, it's all right. Isn't that wonderful? Watch your words. Words have power. They reflect your thoughts. They increase your thoughts and give more power to your thoughts. Be careful of your words. Recognize that what you do matters. It matters to you, it matters to others. And when we're careless, when we're negative, when we're cavalier, and we're not watching ourselves, we're not watching our thoughts, we're not watching our words, we're not careful of our actions, we're like the bull in the china closet. We can do so much destruction. We can do so much destruction. We can cause so much hurt and pain. But when we make our words sweet, when we make our thoughts of God, when we keep our mind always focused on the light, and this doesn't mean that you don't practice discrimination. If you see somebody of a character that you see as carrying them in a way that's going to create a lot of suffering for them and others, you don't necessarily spend all your time with them, because that's not what you want to be incorporating into your own life. But nevertheless, even if you choose not to associate with them, see the light of God within them burning brightly. Always see that hope. Always see whatever good is being offered to you and hold on to that. So we don't have to associate with them, but we should always see God within them. That may sound like doublespeak, but there is a way of doing that. There is a way of seeing somebody's reality, somebody in what they're actually doing, and yet hold on to the light in them. What is good there? We may say, well, I don't see anything good there. It's all negative. But, you know, that's not really true. Very rarely are people all bad. Very, very rarely. And so find the good in there. And if you can't find any good in there, think of that innocent light within that person. The innocent light that's within you. Think of times in your life when maybe you didn't behave so well. And yet, now you realize that that light, that innocence, was always dwelling in you. Even when you didn't believe in it. Even when you thought it didn't exist at all, and maybe when you're throwing your shadows out at other people. And yet now you realize that light was always dwelling in you. Well, that light is also dwelling in the hearts of everyone else. And if you can't see it, or you can't perceive it or feel it, just know it in your mind that there is an innocence, there is a light, there is a purity that is unstained by their character. It's true for all of us. And think of that innocent light within their heart that has to face all the storms. If they're a very, very angry person or a rageful person or whatever their nature is that's difficult, that's dark, see that light, that indwelling light, always burning, and what it has to face in these storms of anger, of rage, of destruction, whatever this person is involved with. And think of the pain that that creates. Now, that person may try to bury that light. They may try to put it far away from them. But they cannot destroy it. They cannot change it. They cannot even tarnish it. It always remains. And one day, they will awaken to that fact. And when they do, they will have to face all those things that they've done in their outward journey from God. Even as we have to. And you can feel compassion and sympathy for that individual because you know the price that they're going to have to pay. It may not be in this lifetime, it may not be in the next lifetime, but it will come in their own evolutionary course. And you can have compassion for that because you know what that's like. As we all turn our face towards the light and have to face all those things, you know, it's like taking a journey down a road and going so far down that road. Finally, we decide, you know, I think I've had enough of this road. I'm going to turn around and go back. Well, we have to traipse right back the same way that we came. We have to face all that we've done in our outward journey. And that's true with all. And so you can find that compassion when you think of that inner soul, that inner innocence, that inner light that has to endure all those storms that person's generating. And if you, it's not looking at the personality and saying, oh, well, that's good. Because from a human standpoint, we would say, no, that's going to produce a lot of suffering for them and for others. But we can still look inside and see the good. And that we can take that as a good lesson of what not to be. We can learn lessons from everybody. And sometimes the lesson to learn from some individuals is, there are, but by the grace of God go I. And thank God I'm not in that state of consciousness. Thank God I'm not doing that. There's an excellent example of what not to do. What not to do. And it just emblazons it on our own mind because we're so clear that's not what we want to do. And in that way, they can be a teacher to us. They can be that mirror that's held out in front of us, and we look into that mirror and we go, I don't want that. That's not me. So it helps clarify what's me and what's not me, and that's not me. And I'm going to do just the opposite of what they're doing. But still, you look underneath all of that and you see the light blazing within. It takes practice. It takes attention. And the mind wants to build a case, huh? It wants to see the worst. It really, because why? It makes us feel bigger. We can pat ourselves on the back. You know, that's not, I'm so much better than that person is. But that's not compassion. That's not universal vision. It's not the ultimate consciousness that we're looking to attain. That's just a good ego trip. Oh, look at that person. They're so low on the list. They're so low. That person's not even in kindergarten yet. You know, they're in preschool or maybe pre-life. You know, they're just so low down there. And then, of course, what we do is we end up acting just like that sometime very soon in the future. Just to prove that we are all one. That we are all one. So cultivate that universal vision. Don't adhere to the shadows and the darkness. Don't believe in it. Don't give it power. But focus only on the light. Focus only on God. And when you do that, you awaken that divine intuition. That what you're adhering to as a mental principle in the beginning becomes a living reality to you. And that your belief that all is God and the light of God exists within all people, your inner eye of intuition opens up and you begin to see this entire universe resonating with that music of divine bliss. The walls are singing that. The floor is. Each person that you meet is. Every atom of space. We are literally swimming in an ocean of divine bliss. And yet, who knows it? Who knows it? And that is our duty, is to awaken to that. To become that. So I'll just stop there and see if there are any thoughts or questions that anybody has. Or we can sit in silence too.
Can you talk about how powerful words are? What do you do when you've spoken words that you're not happy about? And how do you take them back?
Yeah. There's a story of a man who asked that question. It's actually a therapist-type story. So he goes to this therapist and he says, you know, I said these bad words, and I'm so sorry. And tell me what I can do to get it back. You know, it's I know it's going to cause damage. I just want to get it back. And the therapist said, all right. So I tell you what. He said, take this sheet of paper here and tear it into little tiny pieces. Okay? So he did that. He had this whole handful of tiny little pieces. And he says, let's go outside. Let's walk outside. So they walked outside. And it was a really windy day. Really windy day. And he says, now, toss the paper in the air. So he did it. And immediately, big gust of wind just took it and blew pieces of paper every which way and up in the air and down the street. Then he said, okay, go collect the paper. He says, I can't. They're gone. I can get maybe one or two little pieces back, but it's gone. He says, the same with your words. They've gone out. And so there's no way to rewrite history in that sense. That what we've said, what we've done, it goes out, it leaves its impression on the world. What we can do in this moment is to recognize the power of those words. Certainly how sorry we are that we ever uttered them and that we gave them that power. And make a determination in ourselves to not do that again, to recognize what the power of words are. That has gone out from us, and it has its effect. And the other thing that we can do is that when it comes back to us, we can understand, this is what I've done, and it's coming back to me. So if people speak ill of me, okay, I can endure that in patience and in peace because this is part of the price that I pay for having done what I have done. The other thing is if possible, we can look to try to make up for what we've done. We can perhaps apologize to people if those people are around, and not for their sake, but for our sake, because we want to try to, you know, put some drops of salve on before what we're cutting wounds. And maybe it's accepted and maybe it's not. Somebody may not be open. But we can at least do what we can to rectify the past. But primarily we can change the present and really recognize how powerful words are. That our words do have an effect on others. And on ourselves. Yeah. Can't change it. And that's true with all of our past. The moment we've done a certain thing, the moment we've thought a certain thing, the moment we've spoken certain words, that moment is past, and it's part of our history now. And there again, just like looking at somebody else and saying, that's a good example of what I don't want to be, we can look at our own history and say, that's a good example of what I don't want to be. And sometimes we really hurt over that. We really hurt. But in that hurting, it purifies the heart. It helps to get rid of that, and we don't want to hurt like that again. So it really imprints it on our mind that I don't want to be like that. So there's a price to pay in that. But if it's a lesson well learned, then you might say the price is worth it from that standpoint. That I really know that's not what I want to do. Sri Yukteswar says that the people living on Hiranyaloka, which is a astral planet, not even just a normal astral planet, but it's like a heavenly celestial realm to the astral world. When people there make the slightest mistake, it causes them a lot of pain. And perhaps some small comfort that, you know, sociopaths feel no pain. They have no empathy with the world. They don't care. And if you have pain over what you've done, at least it makes you a little happier, perhaps, that you're not a sociopath. You know, you have compassion, you have empathy. And if we can make it a lesson well learned, then we can say, well, it led to a goal, a good. You know, that sword of destruction was transformed into a plowshare of planting good seeds.
David, I'm wondering if you would speak about the path the soul travels after the crucifixion. Hmm. Our path is pretty well taken up thinking about the crucifixion,
but I'd like you to speak about that. Well, the crucifixion, as related in the Christian scriptures and describe universal principles, are those experiences that we go through when we are releasing ourselves from the physical consciousness and karma, the astral karma and the causal. And that as we release ourselves from each one of those, we are then in an in-between state, so to speak. We're not what we were once were. We're not yet fully illumined in who we're going to be. Because there's three more stages, and those three stages are in the resurrection. And when Jesus first came out of the tomb, He said, "Don't touch me yet. I've not risen to my Father. I've not gone into that full sat consciousness." So Mary, who represents feeling, cannot yet touch the Christ, or in other words, that we can't enter, there's some danger of entering fully back into material consciousness again. And so we need to tread that very carefully. But in the resurrection, then, the consciousness is lifted up. You go into that full realization of each one of those levels of consciousness, first at the heart, then at the throat, and then at the Christ center, or the Kutasthi Chaitanya at the Ajna here. And that the fullness of that realization comes to you before you feel as if you are dead to the world, you are dead to your old life, the mind is being purified and has been purified, and then you go through this awakening at the heart center, at the throat center, at the sixth center. And it is then that you come into the fullness of realization. And it's only once you've gone through that full resurrection that you then pass through any sense of limitation. And so it is an awakening to your full divine nature on every level. And that happens over time, it happens gradually. And it is the full or complete awakening. Until you come to that place where you are spontaneously residing in that God consciousness, there is no separation, there is no going up or down, in or out. And that is the state of Sahaja Samadhi. natural state samadhi. So from that standpoint, we should not rest satisfied until we have that fullest of consciousness. And we are in that state all the time without any interruption. And until that point comes, we're still, after going through the crucifixion, we're going into the fullness of that realization.
How would you advise one to cooperate with those centers of the throat and the ajna?
Just keeping the mind on God, you have this flow of God consciousness flowing to you and through you. And that even in that state of consciousness, you can make mistakes. And you feel those mistakes very keenly, as I was talking about before, being in these higher astral realms. And through those mistakes, you get self-corrected. You get moved back into the light again. So to stay sincere, to stay surrendered, to stay focused on the light, to continuously move yourself toward that highest attainment, and not to rest satisfied with anything less than that. Until that becomes a continuous stream of consciousness that's unbroken. It's like a river flowing through you. A river of consciousness. It's just flowing. It carries with it intelligence. It carries with it upliftment and joy and bliss. It carries with it the fullness of God consciousness. And there is a part of us who is the witness to that, who watches that. In the final analysis, the witness and the river and all experience is all God. But from a human standpoint, we stand as a witness and watch this consciousness flow through us. And that is the purifying element at that time. Because we're never separated from it. We feel that flow, that flow, that flow. But as I say, there are still some things to expand. There are ways to deepen into that consciousness. Papa said that it was a full 10 years after he established Anandashram, before he had that fullest experience where he was in that continuous state. Mother felt that with Yogananda that he did not have that until the end of his life. That he was still, he's still referring of going in and out of Nirvikalpa Samadhi. So he didn't have that as a continuous. He hadn't attained that. It's very rare, she said, for a soul to attain to that. But that should be our goal, and we should rest with nothing less. So it's that perfect attunement, it's staying in that consciousness, in that flow at all times. And that will purify the mind and the entire body and make us fit instruments for this highest divine consciousness. It's quite a thing. But what we can attain, what we can achieve through that is, you know, it's beyond most philosophies. It's beyond most of what the world conceives of as ever being possible. It's what Jesus, within the story, was crucified for. He says, I and my Father are one. You dare to make yourself one with God? Off with your head. And so our own material mind does the same thing. We cannot conceive of the divine becoming fully manifest within the human. And yet that was the teachings that Jesus came to bring for the West. The West is a broad culture can accept to some degree that it could be true for one individual, but it's not come to the point where it can accept that it's true for all individuals, that that potential lies within everyone. So, as I have shown at one point, it's still advancement to think that it's even true for one individual, because that's a wedge into the door. And through that wedge then can come the greater realization that, as in the first of John, it says that to all them who received him gave he power to become the sons of God. And that all who receive that divine consciousness can become a son of God, and it is to become that fully illumined, fully awakened individual. It's where we're all headed for, whether we realize it or not. How wonderful it is when we awaken to the true purpose in life, that that's why we've come. And that, as I've been shown within, that every aspect of our life is geared to take us all of that way. So we don't have to retire to a cave. We don't have to go far away. Our very life, our work, our family, our social circles are all geared to awaken that consciousness within us. And how wonderful that is. But of course, we have to make the effort. We have to yearn for it. We have to strive for it. That is the price that we pay. We have to surrender ourselves to it. But whatever we have to go through, when we get there, we think, oh, I can't believe it. I remember walking around one time and thinking, this is for free? It's like, it's unbelievable. And yet, who realizes it? Who knows it?
Does the world of delusion and our material mind work against our highest goods so all the time, it seems? Mm-hmm. All the oppositional forces we have to mm-hmm. deal with all the time.
Yeah. When we make a determination to grow spiritually, divine forces and consciousness comes into our life. It organizes all of life, all of our life, all relationships, everything, to be the perfect scenario for us to gain the best spiritual realization. Well, oftentimes that includes us facing all the things that we've done in our outward journey from God. So there are times when we look at our lives and we go, you know, I think maybe I was better off before I started all this. You know, life looked better. And it's because we're having to face ourselves, those very things that we set into motion. If you're going downstream, and if you ever sat in water and just kind of sat in the water and the water carried you downstream, that's pretty fun and pretty easy. But if you ever decide to swim upstream, it's a different story. And so when we decide to change the course of our life, it takes effort, it takes will, it takes desire. But as we do that, that begins to take on a momentum and we feel stronger in that, we grow stronger. But nevertheless, you know, if you've ever been on these large ships, as they change course, just even changing course slightly, the whole ship just starts shaking. You know, it's meeting that resistance. And spiritually within, those are outward forces. Then spiritually within, we have these tremendous spiritual forces being unleashed in our body. It's been compared to an elephant being in a little hut. You know, and it starts to move around a little bit, and then suddenly the hut's moving back and forth, and it's just ready to shake apart. And that's what it's like when our spiritual self begins to awaken within this body. The body is the hut, and the elephant is our spiritual consciousness. And sometimes we feel like we're going to shake apart. I remember times when I felt as if every atom of my body was just going to fly into space and just literally fly into little tiny pieces everywhere. But all of that begins to release our consciousness from this physical body. And through those experiences, even the atoms of our body become realigned. Where before they were aligned with material consciousness, now they're becoming aligned with spiritual consciousness. Now, if you were to take up exercise, what happens if you go out walking? It creates stress on your muscles. In response to that stress on your muscles, your body builds more muscles. And you start to tone up your muscles. They start to get stronger. That happens because you're putting stress on your body system. In the same way, when spiritual consciousness comes in, it puts stress on your nervous system, both your material body, your nervous system within the body, and also the subtle electrical nervous system, the nadis of your astral body. Through that stress that it puts on it, your nerves react by getting stronger. And so you build new connections, you build stronger nerves, until you're able to easily take that energy. What energy you can take, what consciousness you can take in your body right now, a few years ago, you would not have been able to do. But it always seems like we're a little bit behind the eight ball because it's always working on the next generation of nerves. So sometimes we don't feel like we've gotten anywhere. Sometimes it feels worse. Because that consciousness is working so hard to get us into condition, to tone up our nervous system so that we can express through this body and this astral body and this causal body the cosmic consciousness that will allow us to burst all the bubbles and enter into our universal freedom. So in the meantime, it feels like a lot of stress. Now, so much of it is how we interpret life. You know, if we wake up after a good morning, good workout the day before, we wake up and we say, at first we go, oh, that hurts, and then we think, oh, we had a good workout last night. And we have a smile. And because we know that we're getting better, we're getting stronger, we're getting in better condition. And in the same way that when we go through these difficult experiences, if we know that it's working as a tonic for our nervous system, if we're growing spiritually, we can take a positive attitude towards it rather than bemoaning our fate and wondering what we did wrong. And maybe we made a wrong turn. And oftentimes it's an indication that we're doing exactly the right thing. We're on the battlefield. We're exactly where we ought to be. But we entertain this idea that, well, if I start a spiritual life, then everything should just start coming up roses. Everything in my life should just start getting better automatically. And when that doesn't seem to be the case, sometimes things get harder. Certainly we begin to awaken to the joy within us, to the peace within us. But we also have those other experiences coming in that seem to make our life harder. But if we know that those are all geared very specifically for us to awaken us to our true nature, to strengthen this internal system so that we can enter into this cosmic consciousness, then we have a patience about it. Then we have, you know, what Shirdi Sai Baba called courageous patience. And he asked of his devotees two things. He says, keep your mind on me, and have courageous patience. And when we keep our mind on God absolute, and we have courageous patience, then we have a pretty good foundation. But if we keep second-guessing ourselves, and we keep wondering, what did I do wrong, and why is my life going this way, and I must be the most unspiritual person in the entire world, and no spiritual person would ever think these thoughts, or do these things, or speak these words, and we're just facing ourselves. And by keeping our mind on the light, by always striving to improve ourselves and to move forward. We do. But oftentimes it comes too slow for our own liking, and we just want to have it like that. That's just not the way that it works. We see some examples of some marvelous saints who just seem to get it like that. But they're not very good measuring markers for us, usually, because for most of us it's a gradual awakening. Many times they were born with that realization already intact, and when they are ready, they just awaken to it. In a sense, we're also the same way, but our minds are unwilling to accept it because of our own past history, and so we just find it really hard to accept. Where because they have done the work before, their minds are very malleable, they're very open. One of the things Babaji was once quoted as saying, he said, the individual personality determines their path. If one is very accepting and very open, they attract to themselves a path that's very accepting and very open. If the mind is very critical and very hard, they attract to themselves a path that's very critical and very hard. It's very interesting. And sometimes very telling about our own sadhana and our own path. And the more we can cultivate that openness, that acceptance, sometimes the easier we can make it on ourselves. That trust. And if we can start out with that trust, all is happening exactly according to God's will. You know, the first thing that Swami Satchitananda read of Papas before he was Swami Satchitananda and had gone onto the path was something from the Vision magazine, and Papas said, the world is exactly as it ought to be. Now, if any one of us were to read that statement, we'd probably have as many different reactions as there are people in this room right here. But Swami Satchitananda thought a very interesting thing. He thought, it would take a very great man to be able to say that. That's not an easy thing to say or to realize. And so he felt an immediate attraction for Papa. But that's what he thought. It would take a very great man to be able to say this. The world is exactly as it ought to be. Your world is exactly the way it ought to be. And that includes you. And when we can accept that, we accept that God is in us, God is in His perfection within ourselves and within this world. And that's the easy way to realization. If you want a shortcut, that's it. But it's not so easy to accept. That's our problem. Our minds are not malleable to it. Kind of hangs on to the old. Can't be that easy. I've got to suffer. So we attract a path that creates some suffering for us, just to prove to us that we've done something. Yeah, it's the nature of the mind. Yeah, once you accept separation, then separation leads to separation, to more separation, to more separation. Once you accept wholeness, then it all becomes one. But once you accept the idea of separation, it just gets invested in more and more separation, breaking things down into smaller and smaller pieces, making things more and more difficult.
That's true. Even the way we perceive the mind.
Yes.
Like if we perceive the mind as all part of God too, mm-hmm. our growth, and not to see it as the enemy, right?
Yes. Then even ourselves, in our imperfection, we are exactly the way that we ought to be. We are perfect if we can accept it. Mm-hmm. We are filled with God, even in this moment. If we can accept it, if we can, it can't be a mental game. It can't be mental gymnastics. Oh, okay, well, I'll accept that. And, you know, but that clever mind is doing it, and it's kind of working the angles. It's not really accepting it. it's not really receiving it. But to all them that received it, gave he power to become the sons of God. So when we make our minds malleable, open, receptive, and that's why Papa says it's all grace. It's all grace. Well, if you can really open your mind to the fact that it is all grace, then it is all grace, and you have it in that moment. But the mind wants to break it down and said, no, it can't be like that. The story's over. And I don't want the story to be over. I'm not ready for it to be over. Now, I once thought God showed me something I thought was very funny. And it was somebody who was in a multiplex theater, like a movie theater. And they were watching this beautiful, delightful movie, right? And as those multiplex theaters, sometimes you can hear the movie next door. So they could hear these explosions and these terrible sounds and roars and all this kind of stuff. So they thought to themselves, you know, they're not having a very nice movie over here, but I bet they'd enjoy my movie. So they go out of their movie and they walk over to the other theater and they go, psst, psst, come over and watch my movie. You know, it's delightful, it's wonderful, it's full of light and beautiful things. No, get out of here. I'm in the middle of my movie. I want to watch the end. You know, I'm not ready to give up on it yet. No, come. Look at this terrible movie over here. Come over to my movie. No, I'm in the middle of this movie. I don't want to break away from it yet. You know, you can see somebody doing that. They don't want to leave their movie. We get invested in the play. We're interested in it. We want to see how it ends. So we don't want to leave it, and so we stay invested in it. We stay in the theater, and if the person gets insistent enough for other people to leave that movie, they'll throw them out. Of course, that's what happened to Jesus. Threw him out of the world. He said, we don't want you. And it happens to many prophets and many who are speaking these truths. So people get invested in their play, they get invested in their movie. They don't want to switch. And just, that's why I never go after anybody for this path, because this path is difficult. It takes all of our courage, it takes all of our concentration. And you kind of drag somebody reluctantly coming into it, it's difficult enough for those of us who are enthusiastic for it. Forget of it if you're reluctant, you know. I mean, you just, the first little thing you stumble on your big toe, you're out of there. Well, I don't like this. I'm gone. So that inner calling needs to be there. Something that's beyond, I'm here to please somebody else, or, you know, I'm here because I think this is going to be easy, or whatever that calculating mind, it's got to be a deeper calling than that. It's got to awaken something deep in our soul that says, you know, I'm willing to do whatever to realize this, to make this happen. I'm willing to go through whatever. And when we get to that dedication, when we get to that level of surrender, then we're really putting our feet on the path. But even getting to that point is back and forth. That's what most of our sadhana is about, is kind of purifying the mind to where we can really get to that point where we can say, I can give myself wholeheartedly to this. 100%. And that's what I think when we look at the lives of great spiritual masters, of mother, of master, of papa. They had such dedication. They had such clarity of purpose and thought. And that's why they made the progress. That's why they made the goal. They weren't mixed. And it's not, for instance, in Papa's situation that he had to leave his family. He left the family because he felt an inner calling. But he had to have that, you know, direct perception. He had to have that tremendous desire. That's the essential. Mother was never... She, for a while, she was pulled out of her family in the sense that she went to Anandashram and to India, but she came back to her family. You know, there are times when we're taken out of the world for periods of time. but we don't have to. That's not the issue. This world is not the problem. This body is not the problem. The idea of separation is the problem, and that's what needs to be healed. And to heal that, we have to make that determination. I'm willing to surrender and give up anything and everything in order to get that. And when we do, then we get it, and then we realize that everything is a part of it. But we have to have that willingness to say, I'm willing to give up everything. And it can't be a trickster part of the mind that says, if I say I'm willing to give up everything, then I get everything. So I'll say that I'm willing to give up everything so I can get everything, because that's what I want. That's not surrender, of course.
It's not sincere.
It's not sincere, and it doesn't get us the goal. Mm-hmm. But we have to have that attitude where we have that willingness. Whatever you say, whatever it takes, I'm willing to do. Yeah.
So this willingness you have to innately have, is that?
It's something that's awakened in us, yeah. Yeah. It's a deeper calling. And as I say, much of our sadhana is surrounded around getting to that total clarity. But to start with, it can't be just an intellectual curiosity, or it can't be just a casual kind of encounter. It's got to call to us on some deeper level. And unless it does that, we wear out. You know, it's something we try for a while and we say, oh yeah, I used to do that one time. But it doesn't stick with us. We don't stick with it because it doesn't become compelling, like Master said here. It has to be so compelling it's every aspect of our life. Otherwise, we've never really heard the calling. Now, that doesn't mean we start out in that place. But where we do start out is, it is a deeper calling. It's beyond our own reason. It's beyond our own logic. It's calling to something deep in our soul. So it does need to be that. Yeah. When I started this path, I came kicking and screaming. I was not in favor of it. This little me. You know, I thought I was cursed. Because I thought, why can't I be happy with life like I see a lot of my friends happy with life? You know, but this deeper calling was coming that took me, it was beyond my own reason. And I didn't understand it, and I didn't have a name for it. I certainly didn't have the word God attached to it. It's just, I was miserable. But it was a misery with the world. I didn't see any promise in the world. I didn't see any potential in the world. But I didn't know where to get my bearings at. And it wasn't until really I met Mother that it really became more and more clarified in my mind. Ah, this is what I'm being called to. I had little hints along the way, but when I met her, it started to really mature. And it's pretty miserable when you're so unhappy with what you have, but you don't have any name for where you're going. And so even just to have a name for it is pretty nice. It's pretty nice, yeah. But to achieve that, we have to kind of enter into that, I'm willing to give up everything to get there. And when we do that, then we have it. And then we realize everything is a part of it. That's the irony. It's God's great joke. You ever seen the television show MASH? And you see them, that it shows them, they're looking into the camera and they have field glasses and they're looking off into the camera. You can see behind them comes the helicopter. That's what they're looking for. And it's not until it's right on top of them do they turn around, kind of start, oh, here it is. You know, it settles down. And that's the way we are. We're looking out here in the world for our happiness, for our joy, for our fulfillment. And all the time, God is right here. It's like the story of Krishna, where the great demon comes to destroy Krishna. And the demon tears up the world looking for Krishna, and tears up the whole cosmos looking for him. And finally gets tired of the game and he goes away. Suddenly Krishna's back out. People going, Krishna, Where have you been? This terrible demon was trying to destroy you and looking everywhere for you. Krishna says, it's in the one place I knew he would never look. I was in his own heart. And that's our case. God is right in our heart. He is our self, our very self, but we're looking everywhere except here for that happiness, for that fulfillment, for that ananda bliss, for that chit, light, and love. We look everywhere outside of ourselves except where God is and in our own heart. And then we look there one day and we see him smiling at us. He said, why did you ever doubt I was here? And then we're so overjoyed at the reunion that we don't even bother to be mad at him.
Mm-hmm. But I don't find that there's a contradiction in being in that struggle and simultaneously on being on a path that understands that there is no struggle.
Yeah. It's very true. We're called to action. We're all called to action. As long as we breathe, as long as we take in food, we are in the field of action of this world. And so on one level or another, we're all called to action. We all called to manifest that light in this life. When we take up causes, the one thing we need to be careful of is that our overarching goal is the universal vision. And that even when Rama was killing Ravana, he recognized the light within him. And he recognized him as a great soul. And the danger where we can get lost in taking up causes is we lose sight of the fact that all have that light within them. And so to remember that universal vision. It was very enlightening to me when I had a professor of history talking about Gandhi. And Gandhi was, of course, a great advocate of ahimsa, of nonviolence. And, of course, one of the things that he did is he went on fasts when there was violence going on in order to get people to behave. Now, why would people care whether Gandhi lived or died? The reason that many people cared was because they realized that if he died, the violence that would ensue from his death, because people were upset about that, would dwarf any other kind of violence that was going on then. So the irony in his life was that he was getting people to behave with the threat of violence, even though he taught nonviolence. You add to that the other aspect that he was doing violence against his own body by starving it to death. And so for somebody who believed so purely in nonviolence, he was committing violence against his own body and he was getting people to behave under threat of violence. And that's nothing against Gandhi, it's only that you cannot escape the paradoxes in life. And that the mind, when it adheres to one side of the struggle, is fine. That's good and it's necessary when it represents our highest light. But for us always to cultivate that higher wisdom, that higher vision in the universal. And certainly we must all act and to feel called to action and not act on that is worse than, you know, to retire in some cave someplace, or that's not what we're called to. We are called to the field of action. And to do that with integrity, to do it according to our own highest light, is just what it is. Mm. So I see no contradiction.
Can I ask you to speak about a question that the young people I work with often ask me?
Mm.
They find it easy to believe in God, but they can't understand why so many children can be born into such poverty and suffering.
Mm. Yeah, it's, you know, the kind of the essential aspect of that question is, why is there suffering? Why is there suffering in this world? And when we look at the nature of this world, we see that this world cannot exist without suffering to some extent, that within the animal kingdom, that animals kill other animals for food. That there is this cycle of violence going on, the cycle of pain, that, as the Buddha discovered, old age, illness, and death are inevitable to happen to this body. And so suffering is inevitable. I make a distinction between suffering and pain. As we discussed earlier, if you wake up with pain and it's from having a good workout the day before, you even have a smile on your face. That's not suffering, even though your body is having some pain. When we look at pain caused in this world and we see no meaning to it, then we see it as suffering. When we see that there is meaning in it, that it is working towards a higher good, then we can change the mind from seeing it from suffering, and we have compassion for the pain, but we see it as working out a higher good. That's very difficult to see with children, and I've used as an example before my own experience of seeing a previous incarnation where I was a child in the midst of a war-torn city and devastation all around and within his own family. And I asked God why, and God immediately showed me an earlier incarnation where I had wreaked havoc on other people through war. I created pain for other people through my own actions. And I was reaping the consequences to those actions. It is impossible to understand or assign any meaning to suffering, particularly of children. Why would a child be born and then die just a few days later? Why would a fetus die within the womb? Why do some children be born in very difficult situations? For children in particular, it's hard to see. But through my own revelation, through my own experience, I saw that there is a very definite cause and effect relationship between what I had done in a previous incarnation and what I was reaping in terms of the effects in this current incarnation. Now, unless you have the idea of reincarnation, it's very difficult to see any meaning or any justice in any of that. But my own experience showed me that there is a very exacting law of cause and effect. And not only that, but it was helping me to work out my own karma. My determination had been to go back to the light after that incarnation where I had wreaked so much violence on other people's lives. And those experiences were helping to release me. Now, once having had those experiences, that suffering as a child, I could no longer kind of wreak violence on a child again without seeing myself in that child. Unless I had had that experience, I could never have that full and complete compassion for a child suffering. Now, none of this excuses bad behavior. Those who are wreaking violence on those children who are suffering, they will have to pay a very exacting cost with that also. But it does explain how there is suffering in this world, how there is meaning to that pain that individuals go through. And that within the hearts of all resides the Comforter. And that if we open our hearts to God, even when we're in pain, that Comforter can come in and give us peace, can give us assurance, can give us love, even when we don't have it anywhere around us. And that that ability is there for everyone. Not everyone takes advantage of it, but it is there for everyone. And it does not necessarily remove the pain, but it does remove the suffering when that Comforter comes in and gives us peace. The other aspect to that is that there are different kinds of pain and suffering. What I saw when I was in India were children who had the clothes that they wore basically as possessions. They probably had enough food to eat, but probably not in superabundance. But they had a light on their face. They had a light in their eyes. They had a gentleness in their nature. They had respect for their parents. And I saw in them many advantages that our children don't have. I was in one ashram and I heard this great whining about how the salad was gone and how something else wasn't there and they didn't like anything. And I just thought, I haven't heard that since I've been in India. And I turned around and it was a young Caucasian teenager, you know, from California in her best whining voice. I thought, you know, with all the lack and deprivation, I've not heard one child respond that way. It's much more likely that they have a smile on their face and that they have bright light in their eyes. So there's many different kinds of suffering that go on. And we suffer from great mental suffering. Others may have physical deprivations, but we have great emotional and mental suffering, even though we have physical abundance.
But what I'm trying to now do is say maybe some of that suffering is going to teach you something. That you need to take a step to do something.
Yeah.
That's my approach, is mobilizing them into doing things.
Certainly, yeah. Yeah. That it awakens. That it awakens compassion, and that compassion turns into action.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. And that they have a responsibility to themselves to manifest the light, to do well in school, to be good children, not, you know, to be respectful to their parents and teachers and so on, that by them manifesting more light, we can bring more light into this world and have it spread all over this world. And so when we awaken compassion, we also awaken the light within us. And certainly to have great compassion for those who have any kind of suffering, whether that's physical or mental or emotional.
Yeah, at least they can recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really helpful.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things they maybe will identify is what kind of poverty they exist in. That may not be physical poverty, but it may be other kinds of poverty. And it's very interesting. I heard somebody ask Swami Satchidananda when I was there that exact point about why children there seem to have such a light in their face and their eyes. And in America, oftentimes, we don't see that. And is it mental or is it spiritual? And he said a very interesting thing. He said, I think it's mental. And I think that's where it starts, is it's the mental cultivation, it's the bombardment of television, it's the bombardment of these games and everything that they're exposed to, and it affects the mind in a way that makes them unhappy, even though they have a level of abundance that most of the world has never known. And yet they're unhappy. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that there is a potential. I look at the 20-something generation, the ones who are coming up, I see so much intelligence, I see so much sensitivity, but I see no inspiration. So much of it is dark. You know, the art, the preoccupations of the mind. It's all around darkness. It has no optimism. It has no upliftment. It has no light. I see there's such a great potential for an awakening, for something to sweep through that will capture their imaginations, that will capture their idealism, that will lift them up to a higher level. I see so much potential there. But it's a crisis in the making. It is a crisis in what we see oftentimes, because they're given so much, and yet they're looking around and they say, you know, what's the meaning? What's the meaning? And of course, the meaning is theirs to find. They bring the answer with them. But it's not being manifest yet. And I see such great potential, but as in crisis, there is also danger. And so we see the danger of drugs, we see the danger of just promiscuous sex, we see the danger of this dark energy coming in and just sweeping through to people who don't feel any higher calling or can't identify a higher calling. And yet I see all the potential there for a great awakening. A great awakening.
You know, I there is a lot of hope there, because there is awakening happening and it's being sought for. And I think that we, as hopefully enlightened people, need to give them and facilitate. I just spent 4 days with 90 youth and saw them all awaken. It was miraculous.
Isn't that wonderful?
Oh, yeah.
See all these little lights.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is there, but there's a great responsibility for us, particularly in that age group where they're looking for something that would give them the right meaning.
Right. Right.
And support them.
Well, God bless you for your work.
God's work, I'm just a
Ramakrishna said, We're the machinery, God's the operator. We have our closing prayer. This closing prayer by Mother is a product of her own realization. But it is also an affirmation of our own mind. Something to aspire to, as well as a reflection of our own experience. So when we say these words, to feel them and the impact of them, let it awaken your soul to that greater light, that greater knowledge and awareness. You pray with me. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of
Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with Thy healing light.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Peace. Thank you so much for coming out on this rainy night. A couple of announcements. December 1st and 2nd, we're going to be having another class on the clearing and charging exercises. This one will be a fuller one than we had at Maple Ridge than last time. We were a little cramped for time last time. So it will be Saturday and Sunday from 9 o'clock to about 5:30 on Saturday and 9 o'clock to about 5 on Sunday, which the clearing and charging exercises will be taught in their entirety. And that's December 1st and 2nd, Saturday and Sunday. And just can't encourage you enough to be there, just because I'm so enthusiastic about what these exercises can do. Then on December 8th at Maple Ridge, we'll also be having a Christmas celebration, potluck with service afterwards, and time will be 5:30. Okay. Well planned in advance, you can tell. So 5:30 until we finish. So should have some Christmas carols and some good food, and
hopefully Al will play.
That would be wonderful to have Al play. So then we will have Christmas celebration down in Seattle, December 23rd, I think. It's a Sunday, and I think Christmas is Tuesday, if I have the dates right. It's that Sunday just before that. And then that's in the morning, so at 11 o'clock service, and then we have potluck afterwards on that Sunday. And so that allows people plenty of time to get back to up here if you've driven that extra distance. Also on Christmas Eve, if anybody would like to come down, we probably find housing, hopefully, for anybody who'd like to come down, but we have New Year's Eve service, and that goes from 8 o'clock p.m. to midnight. And it's a wonderful way to bring in New Year's. And you can go home drunk on the Lord, rather than drunk as the Lord.
Are the clearing exercises in Maple Ridge, David?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I just feel such great love for all here. Just can't speak enthusiastically about this life. I just feel like I want to be the Pied Piper or the Johnny Appleseed, you know, to spread this, because there's just so much joy, light, and love in it. What a transformation this world would go through for all here to rise up into that consciousness, to know it completely, as we're talking about. I don't even play a flute. So may God and Guru's blessings be upon you. May He ever keep you in His presence, ever focused upon the light. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. Victory to God, victory to the light. And for all this world, may that light spread.